This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
I'm a senior archivist here. I've been here at Archives New Zealand for about 8 years. The difference between our holdings and other institutions is that we hold the New Zealand government record. So we don't go out to collect a broad range of community-based records such as Alexander Turnbull Library may collect. We certainly don't purchase records. The records come to us usually directly from the government agency that has created or used or inherited those records. That's the main difference between us and a library or a large institution like Alexander Turnbull or the Hocken or Auckland War Memorial Museum.
So can you give me an example of a government agency? What are we talking about?
Government agency might include a ministry, would include the courts, New Zealand police, government departments, it includes royal commissions, includes government agencies involved in health and education. Schools in the past have deposited material with us, either directly or through the erstwhile education boards. So it's a fairly broad range of institutions around the country that we broadly call government agencies.
So would it go as far as, say like the New Zealand AIDS Foundation, which is funded via the Ministry of Health?
No, it wouldn't. That's a standalone organisation that exists with financial support, but it is not deemed to be a New Zealand government agency. As a trust or as a separate entity, it has its own life outside government.
So can you give me the scope of the collections, the size and how far back the collection's going?
We collect records regardless of medium. So if they are deemed to be a permanent value, perpetual value, then we would take them in if they're New Zealand government records. Now, that can be film, it can be audio tape. It can, in some limited instances, be published material, but usually it will be one-off material. It can be old-fashioned paper files. It can be artwork, if the artwork is deemed to be a government record, such as, for example, the National Collection of War Art. That is a government record. It's a record of New Zealanders' experience in places and times of war. So the scope extends as broadly as it can in terms of medium. Now we're moving more into bringing in born digital records, so they do not have to be hard copies. They can be born digital. The size of the holdings, well, that's a moot point. Here in the Wellington office, by far the largest repository, we have approximately 80 kilometres of shelving, or the equivalent of 80 kilometres of shelving in this building. We've got smaller holdings in the Auckland, Christchurch and Dunedin offices, but certainly it would be well over 100 kilometres of shelves of holdings. Our earliest record, rather bizarrely, is not, in fact, it couldn't be deemed to be a New Zealand government record. But it was given to the New Zealand government. It's a letter from Captain James Cook to Captain Clark on the second voyage Cook made around the world. So it was given to New Zealand by the City of London, and it ended up in archives here. That's by far our oldest record, but most of the records we hold are from 1840 onwards, when a European-style government bureaucracy is created here. So a bureaucracy of that sort starts creating records. So the records start from that point and grow in size from then on, yeah.
And so is it compulsory for government agencies to deposit with you?
No, it's not compulsory. Determinations have to be made about whether or not the records are deemed to be of permanent value. Certainly not all records are kept permanently. All government agencies are held by the conditions of the Public Records Act. So the relationship and the the fact of whether they are beholden to deposit certain records with us is determined by that act. So that becomes the field in which we work. The parameters are set by the act. There would be an enormous quantity that's held long-term by an agency and then disposed of one way or another after a specified period of time. As you can appreciate, the amount of record created nowadays, it's simply impossible to keep the lot. Can't be done.
In relation to rainbow communities, what does Archives New Zealand hold?
We hold here wondrous treasures, I think is the best way to put it. We hold records here from agencies, New Zealand government departments, about those government agencies' relationship and dealings with New Zealand people, so that it can be any one of many, many, many agencies that will have had dealings with members of our communities. So they may be the fairly obvious kinds of records. They may be records like court records or police records, but they can be a much wider set of records. So there's no narrow scope where our records sit within the larger holdings. That makes searching sometimes quite slow and makes surprises even more wonderful. I would say possibly the majority of records will be those records that fall within law in the broadest sense, and also within governance or parliamentary process. We have a significant number of records that relate to things such as parliamentary select committee hearings and findings, petitions and so on. But there's certainly more wider scope than just those. Maybe we have an opportunity here to even bring up a specific example here. I have on the table here in front of me a small selection of some of the records that we've identified over the last few years. One of them is a collection of newspaper clippings that has come to us from the old National Parliamentary Research Unit. Now, they will have, over the decades, collected newspaper clippings from around a vast number of topics that they decided to keep tabs on what was out there in the public arena. This one here, this record here, is a box full of paper, newspaper clippings regarding homosexual law reform. So that if I just open the box up, and we will just see that it's a relatively unsorted pile of newspaper clippings, but nevertheless would be incredibly useful for a researcher, in that it brings together what's in the public arena, and it also shows us what was available easily to parliamentarians when they were wanting to research homosexual law reform, so that the service provided within the parliamentary services have bequeathed that to us. So we can now look back and say, well, what was it parliamentarians in previous parliaments were laying their hands on to make their decisions?
So it's not just about the object, but it's actually where the object came from, who was using it and why they were using it.
Yes, exactly. And what influence it may have had on decision making. If one analysed the newspaper reports that have been clipped out of the papers and put in there, are they supportive of law reform? Was there a suggestion, even looking in them, that there was a bias against law reform? We don't know until we actually had a really thorough look what newspapers were being sourced. Were they just the large national papers that were providing that sort of information? Or maybe something like The Listener? Or was it smaller, local, regional, and even small town papers that were being sourced? And were those local community opinions or purported opinions being made available in that way to MPs? That's the kind of research you could get, perhaps, from a record such as this.
Are there other topics covered by the parliamentary library that have got kind of rainbow connections?
Yes, yes, certainly. Well, coming out of Parliament, if I speak more broadly about Parliament itself as well as the research unit, we have here a wonderful record entitled, it's from the 37th Parliament, so it's 1975, and it's from the Privileges Committee, and it's an inquiry they made into Carmen, and when she spoke on television, she made some statements on television about the statistical probability of there being homosexual members of Parliament, and this caused great ruckus, and she was hauled before the Parliamentary Privileges Committee. And so this is a record of those events. Now we would find that utterly absurd to even suggest that she was impugning the moral the vigour, the purity of the parliamentarians, but at that time it was considered that she had overstepped the mark, and so there is a record of that happening in 1975, and her response also to the accusation and the charge that she had breached parliamentary privilege.
And I'm not sure, was she found kind of guilty of breaching, or how did it...
Essentially, yes, my understanding from memory is that, yes, it was a breach of privilege, and there were repercussions. So the difficulties were not only for herself, but also I'm pretty sure in those days it was still the NZBC, so the interviewer, there were a number of people became involved in it. I don't remember any severe sanctions placed against her, but there was the potential of that happening. Breach of parliamentary privilege there can be severe outcomes from that. So we have a number of such reports and other things coming out of Parliament, or parliamentary services, parliamentarians. We have one here, for example, much more recently. It's the Justice and Electoral Committee, and they're reporting upon the Civil Union Bill. So once the bill had been submitted and then submissions are made in response to the bill, we can now look at how it was that committee responded the report that they wrote as a response to public feedback they got.
So is everything that's tabled in Parliament, does that eventually come to archives?
Not necessarily, as I understand, but usually. Our holdings for records that are tabled go way, way back into the 19th century. So very frequently they will be... I'm not aware of many of them that early, or any of them, in fact, that early, having a specific rainbow connection or LGBTI connection, but certainly there are petitions, there are reports of this, that and the other.
So things like, say, the anti-homosexual law reform petition from 85, 86, do you have that?
I've never cited it, but I assume so, because we do hold petitions once they come to us. The most famous of which is the Women's Suffrage Petition of 1893, the final and successful petition. That is by far the most famous of those petitions, but there are many, many petitions that come through to us. They can be quite small, and they can be of tens of thousands of signatories. Yeah.
So how long does it take you to process and accession something after the event? So you've got civil unions from, 2005-ish? How long did it take it before it's publicly available?
That is incredibly variable. Records don't necessarily come to us immediately or promptly. There is a kind of understanding that records should be available for us to make a determination about after 25 years, but not necessarily. Some records will come much sooner than that if they are not needed for any further government or business. If a government function ceases to exist, then the records might come to us, something like a royal commission. Once that royal commission is wound up, then that that function of the government examining those matters, that finishes so the records become available to us very quickly. Other records might remain with an agency because they say, well, we might need them or we are still using them even many years later. Other records, to be honest, maybe just sitting somewhere. And there are plenty of instances of records sitting in places and being unearthed, as it were, and then people making an appraisal of how to deal with them, what's the appropriate place for those to go, do they need to be kept forever, and so on. So that's a very, very variable outcome for records once they're created, or once they're finished with, even. Yeah.
And just thinking about, say, the Select Committee for the Civil Union Act, that was all public, or well, I think most of it was. When it comes to Archives New Zealand, is it still public? Can the public still access that material freely?
Yes. These records that I've got here with me today, these are all public, open records. And I wouldn't be talking about them particularly if they were not unrestricted or open. Certainly there are large numbers of records that are restricted, have restrictions placed on their access. That usually is for privacy reasons. It may be for preservation reasons. The record may be too delicate and too fragile, so we would make the record available in some other format. Some of them may be restricted for reasons of for diplomatic sensitivities, national security and so on, physical security, building plans, for example, of Parliament House are not available to the general public. But by the most part, the records we deal with are restricted either under the Privacy Act or under the Clean Slate Act. So those that relate to criminal convictions have limitations placed upon their access. So that has a direct impact when we're dealing with the histories of gay men being charged under the Police Offences Act, for example. Those records are not necessarily available for quite some time. However, in that instance, and in all instances where a record is restricted, there are provisions for a researcher to make application for access for research purposes, and conditions may be placed on that researcher. The agency that still controls their records might want to be satisfied that personal privacy is no longer placed at risk. For example, evidence that that individual has passed away might be required, and then privacy is no longer such a great concern. So there are ways in which you can do research even if the records are nominally restricted. There's just some other processes and procedures to go through to get the permissions.
Are you aware of some kind of significant court cases or police cases involving rainbow people that you have material on?
Yes. We have an interesting record here in front of me now. This is... But it's not so much a police file. There's police involvement in it. And I will show you the photos. And the photographs of this remarkable woman will be going online, I understand. But here she is here. Her name is Dr. Van Danneville. She stated that she was Danish. Now, this record that we have of her about her dates from the First World War. She came to the notice of the authorities because they weren't sure whether she was Danish or German. She was not a British subject, so therefore she was deemed to be an alien. They had to decide whether she was an enemy alien or not. Now, as you can see from the photographs, she wore men's clothing for the tie, the high collar, the jacket, the watch chain. She wore very short hair, but she did at the same time wear a very long skirt. She's a most wonderful dress sense, an extraordinary woman. She lived with a woman in Kilburn. Some research has been done into her. Certainly she warrants a lot more, but we're assuming that a great deal of her difficulty with New Zealand authorities is that they couldn't quite deal with the fact that not only weren't they sure about her political allegiances during times of war, First World War, but maybe they couldn't actually deal with the clothes she wore. They couldn't deal with her views on medicine, for example. They couldn't deal with the fact that she was quite probably the lover of a woman and they were living together up in Kilburn. So there are a lot of... She came to the attention of police and army authorities because of that. And so, and we have a fairly good file about her and a verbatim record of her interviews with the figures who... the personnel who interviewed her and tried to work out how they were going to deal with her in the middle of the war. Was she a threat to national security, for example?
How did she come to the attention of the authorities?
She, like anyone who was not a British subject at that time, would have been investigated during the period of the First World War. And they immediately would have decided that she was an alien, i.e. not a British subject. Then they had to make a determination. Was she an enemy alien? Was she a German national? Although she said she was of Danish background. And some of the documentation in here suggests that they weren't sure whether to believe her or not. Because everything else in her story is pretty fluid. She's not someone who's going to stick to the hard and fast rules of society, so she's presumably a bit suspect, as far as a very straight-laced society would have been at the time of the concerns and even the paranoias that swept around in that period from 1914 to 1918.
So in the documentation, are they open about, say, her relationship with another woman? The kind of language that's being used, are they using words like lesbian? Or?
No, I'm not aware of that. It's quite some time since I've read this. I don't remember that being stated, but it is mentioned that she lives in Kilburn. That is simply part of the mosaic of her nonconformity, I think, rather than something to absolutely focus on at that time. They were just on edge, it seems, because of her general nonconformity in dress and her attitudes towards modern Western medicine, for example. She had a clinic she ran out of Miramar from memory, which was probably what nowadays we would call of a holistic nature rather than a very, a straight science-driven, medical profession-driven approach to illness and well-being. So she stepped outside the boundaries in a lot of ways. Yeah.
When you're looking at these early records, do you have tips for the kind of language that kind of flags somebody as possibly different, rainbow? What words do you look for?
I did a little test earlier today, just checking on our main listing system for indecent assault, and I took that test as following your suggestion when you'd emailed me earlier. So using terms or words like that can be useful, but indecent assault can certainly be perpetrated by a man against a woman, so it's not necessarily a rainbow matter. It's not necessarily relating to two men having sex together, although it may be. But certainly if you're doing research, you would want to get as broad a set of search terms. So I wrote out a small list, printed out a list here of the records that we have listed with the word homosexual in them, and surprisingly there's only 81 in all our millions of records, only 81. So a lot of them are about homosexual law reform, and most of them are relatively recent. One of the oldest ones here, for example, is a 1930 to 1973 record, medical treatment and services, medical special treatment for homosexual prisoners. And this is for Justice Department. Now, that is a restricted record. It is publicly listed. There's no restriction on the listing of that in public. But it's quite likely that that contains the names of individuals. So that is a restricted record, and that would need approvals before that could be made available to a researcher. We have indecent publications, for example, Doubtful Publications, Society and the Homosexual by G. Westwood. So that's been brought to the attention of Customs. So that brings us into another whole field of control of our lives through censorship, for example. And there are a number of censorship-related records that we hold that can be quite useful in examining that way in which we had to interact with the state, and the state impinged on our lives through the decades. I did another search, simply searching for the word lesbian in the titles of records. And here there were only 44 records. So, again, mostly fairly recent and very much to do with the writing of reports, applications for funding for women's suffrage year projects, for example, and so on. So one does have to be fairly broad and rather than just the really obvious keyword searches.
Does the archive retrospectively go back and tag records if it becomes known that this person was homosexual, even though they wouldn't necessarily have used homosexual back then?
Yeah. No, we don't. We don't have a tagging facility on our current listing system. It was used for a short while on another set of records we had on a separate system, but it did not progress. So that idea of tagging is not in use at the moment. There is a facility for adding short notes, so that if a researcher wanted to let us know that something warranted a note, we could add a note. But that's only available for staff members to activate, and we would have to be let know. Some institutions around the world have public tagging and public note making. We don't have that currently.
So if we go back to the example of the doctor in World War One,
mm-hmm.
if we didn't know she was in a relationship with another woman, how would we know she was possibly a lesbian?
We wouldn't. This is one of the factors at work in our holdings, that things come to light through use, and people possibly searching for something else entirely, and coming across records that suddenly shine light on an individual's life, and we say, there's something we couldn't have found out simply by the listings. We might come across them, for example, if there is some kind of, as it were, de facto cross-referencing for something like from papers past, for example. Recently we had a researcher contact us to ask for a copy of an individual's coroner's inquest file that is open, and the person doing the research had been on papers past and discovered that this individual had lived her life, all her adult life, as a woman, but had been born a boy and lived the first several years of her life as a male child. And then sometime in her teens, she took women's clothing, moved well away from where she was brought up, and reinvented her public self as a woman. So that came to light because this person had found reference to that actually in a Truth article. Not surprisingly, it's the sort of thing that appallingly Truth headlined when the matter became public in 1946. Truth's headline is kept a grotesque secret for 41 years. And it only became public knowledge that she had been born a boy and lived her life mostly as a woman after she died. She died very suddenly, and it was the coroner. It was during the coronial inquiry that it became public knowledge that anatomically she was a man. And it was kind of scandalous. It was a terrible event, and the newspapers probably loved it. But to read the coronial inquest now is actually very poignant. She had married, and so to read the statement from her husband, and they had been together for many decades, and his statements, I would take them with a grain of salt. He says he didn't know at the time, and they did not live together and sleep together as man and wife once he found out. We don't know now at this point whether that was the case. But there is a sadness about the story, I personally feel, in that because of the stigma associated, she had to lead her life so hidden that it only became public knowledge upon death. So that is an instance of another source leading the researcher to records we hold.
And what a quandary, because on one hand I'm thinking, oh, the truth, what a nasty little newspaper. But unless you had that newspaper and that article and that headline, you may never have come across the story.
Yes, exactly. And truth is one of those resources that people, particularly for family history purposes, will find out a great deal, because there are a lot of things happening, and always are a lot of things happening in families that are not passed down generation to generation. Whereas at this time, truth was reporting things such as divorces, and it can be a very useful source for people to find information about past members of family or other people where it was not talked about. So truth can be a very useful entry into prohibited histories and purposefully, consciously forgotten histories. One place where you will find very public histories is where that kind of information becomes very public, and Amy Bock being an example of someone whose life is thrown wide open to public examination. And we have a few records regarding Amy Bock. Particularly, I have here on the table some photographs. Now, this is a really good example of a record that has survived from the most unlikely source. The photograph has survived because someone took her photograph and then applied for copyright application, copyright of the photograph. So we have the record is only about Amy Bock because there was public interest in her and the fact that she lived and dressed as a man. And then someone saw that there was a pound to be made there, and so photographed her and got copyright over the photograph. So that's a fairly good example of a fairly obscure source, but nevertheless a wonderfully valuable source if we want to see photographs of Amy Bock.
And can you just describe Amy Bock's story? Like, what kind of era was she in?
Now, Amy Bock was very early 20th century. I have the record. 1909 is the year in which the application for copyright was made. I don't know her life in detail, but she lived... I'm in a bit of a quandary here as to say she or he, because she is always known as Amy, although lived under a number of male personas, with a number of male personas. And whether she identified as a man, she certainly identified as a man publicly, ran into trouble with the law on a number of occasions as a fraudster, and so the courts were told fraudulently married a young woman, and then the young woman found out that her new husband was in fact biologically a woman, and this hit the news. The marriage was dissolved by the state, Personally, I find it interesting that partly her story, but also the ongoing interest in her story. Right up until the 1970s, her story is still told, for example, in New Zealand Heritage magazines that came out. It's the first time I ever saw a photograph of Amy Bok. It was 70 years, or more than 70 years, after the big events where she became... It's not as if she is personally... I would say a historically significant individual in what she did. Maybe it's more to do with the set of anxieties her life unleashed or brought to light within New Zealand society, that there was this discomfort about a woman living her life as a man, and also perhaps it illustrates her life. She maybe felt that she had no options other than to live by certain fraudulent means, financially fraudulent, for example, because other options were closed to her. So those are some of the interesting things that arise out of her life and what we know of her life.
Now, the image that was asked to be copyrighted, is that the one that subsequently was made into a postcard?
No, this is a slightly different one, I think, from what you may be familiar with. But have a look here.
I think that might be the one I've seen.
Oh, that is okay. Yes. It's a lovely portrait of a gentleman sitting with a neat haircut that probably would sit quite well in a lot of coffee lounges in town at the moment, with a high collar again, waistcoat, wearing a medal of some sort that I can't quite make out what it is. So,
and that was dated.
This application is 1909. Now, I don't know whether you want me to speak about other kinds of photos. I know that I don't want to overshadow our discussion about photographs, but they are often very interesting ways in which to get into a story, or there are clues in photos that were not apparent at the time of the making of the photo. For example, we have an album here, official photographs of the 2nd New Zealand Expeditionary Force in the Pacific. So we're talking about the latter part of the 1940s. When New Zealand forces are in the Pacific. And this album here is dated August and September 1943. Now, this is another example of a history that's sitting here, and you would not know to look in this small photo album unless you had an inkling to have a look. And you'll see lots of photos of men in uniform, at work, swimming in the Pacific, more photos of officers, for example, and so on, various army activities in the Pacific. And, of course, one of the activities is drag. These wonderful photographs of performers, soldiers in the field, up in the Pacific, and this performer here, and she's looking damn glamorous, goes by the extraordinary name of Marlena Heatrash. It's a name that will live forever, I reckon. Marlena Dietrich might be quite pleased to be remembered as Marlena Heatrash. We have a number of other performers, drag performers, who were getting together to put on musical entertainment for the rest of the troops while they're out in the Pacific, in Bougainville and other places. We have someone here, perhaps I think he's looking rather a little bit more like, he's looking a little Latin, isn't he? The Carmen Miranda, maybe. Her name here is Minnie from Trinidad. Okay, so I don't know the details of this, but I understand that some of these guys getting into drag performance at this time went on to full careers. to a lesser degree, I think, in New Zealand and more in Sydney.
So what is it like when you're going through albums and you suddenly come across these kind of breadcrumbs, these remnants of kind of hidden histories?
It's a buzz. It's really great. I think I mentioned earlier, there are golden thread. There are treasures sitting within our holdings, and you don't know when you're going to come across them. It's not only a buzz in terms of the immediate thing that you're holding, but also the fact that they may well be a trail to further records. So once having seen these photos and the named performers and their non-drag names, their names as soldiers, then it would actually open up the opportunity for a researcher to say, well, who was this person? Where did he live? What happened after the war, for example? Did he go back into civilian life and live no more in drag? Or did he go into what now we would call a queer lifestyle? We don't know, but these are ways of examining that. If there's a little trail, a few crumbs there, as you said, to lead you on the path of doing research. Yeah. Another really interesting set of records we have, and we go right back perhaps to the beginning of what we're talking about in our communities, dealings with the law, are police records. Now, generally speaking, they are restricted for 100 years. You can get permissions from the New Zealand Police to access those, and you provide them with your reasons, and there may be conditions placed upon your use of the information. But New Zealand Police Gazettes are open earlier than that, and the Police Gazettes do hold some wonderful information. And we do have, for example, here, this will take me just a moment to open this one up, but a Police Gazette, and it's from 1920, and this holds information in here, including a photograph again of Charles Mackay, or Charles McKay. Now, if my memory serves me well, he was had been mayor of Whanganui, or Whanganui as it was known to many at that time, and was charged with attempted murder. He was homosexual, he was a married man. And there is a long story about the circumstances of that attempted murder, why it occurred, the consequences for him, and indeed the consequences for the city. So there's a little remnant of that story sitting in here that would give you a lead in to other police records that might be quite valuable for your record, for your research.
And what was the Police Gazette used for?
The Police Gazettes are a published work, although not made available to the general public. They came out on a fairly frequent basis and were sent out to every police station in the country, and I have a suspicion also to every customs house. So that the local police and customs officers had a record of what was going on in the rest of the country in terms of police business. It might have photos of people who were wanted. It would certainly have information about people who had been charged and found guilty. It would have information about recently released prisoners, so that a local copper wouldn't go hunting down or following up someone who was legitimately on the streets. So there was a frequent information coming out about so-and-so is released from jail. But it will have information about how long they've been there and what the charge was and so on. So the Police Gazettes can be quite succinct in the records they hold, but have a really nice set of detail there about individuals either wanted or currently under arrest or recently released and so on. So they are a wonderful resource. They've only just been Not all of them, but many of them have been digitised and can be viewed online. So they're a great resource. One of the other sets of records I know that there was some interest in as to whether they held information to Rainbow researchers and researchers in our, into our lives, in our community lives, are the First World War military service records. These have all been digitised and put online. I'm not aware of there being any specific references. If there were, I think generally it might only show up, if it did exist, it would probably show up in court-martial type records. Because I think if there might be inferences, you might be able to get inferences of a man nominating as his best, his next of kin, another man who's simply categorised as friend. Certainly that wouldn't always be the case, that they were lovers, but if you were being sent overseas, then maybe you might nominate, if you had a male lover and you were a man going overseas, you might nominate your lover as your next of kin. So there might be ways of reading those records with an open mind and to see whether they might lead you to further investigation and further results. But that would have to be done fairly carefully, I think, with those records. You wouldn't want to make too many assumptions about the nature of relationships. There would have been many men going overseas who had no family, for example, in New Zealand, and therefore simply did nominate another good male friend. So how that would work, one would have to kind of think about how you were interpreting that information.
Unless, I guess, you came from the standpoint that everyone's homosexual until proven otherwise.
Well, true enough, yes, yeah. Yes, I can't argue with that one. I think there would be a fair number of records in there that would be recording the lives and experiences of men who enjoyed the loving and sexual company of other men. Their lives would be recorded in First World War service records, but not that aspect of their lives. So they may well be useful for enlarging the picture of a known individual you might be researching. Yeah.
Just going back to the political records, and we were talking about how things tabled in Parliament often come to Archives New Zealand. What about personal correspondence to members of Parliament? So, for instance, Fran Wilde had quite a few papers that were destroyed in a Kilburnie storage unit. Wouldn't they have come to somewhere like Archives New Zealand, or is there a difference between personal papers and...
Yes, there is, and my understanding of this is that under the Act that we operate under, Section 42 of the Act does have some stipulations about which of those records come to us or are eligible to come to us, which we may take in, and generally they only apply to ministers' papers. So if you are not a minister, but you are an MP, then your papers remain yours. So that's your business in your relationship with your electorate, your relationship with the broader community, your relationship with the Parliament and your party, if you are a member of a party, so that those records do not have to come to us. Ministers' papers, yes, they may come to us, but not necessarily, and it's a matter of working through the various ways in which that section of the Act can be applied and as to whether we would want to take in that minister's papers or not. Certainly some minister's papers don't come to us, they will go to other repositories. So our holdings, for example, of prime ministerial papers is quite patchy in that some prime ministers have lodged their papers with other institutions for whatever reason, and that's her or his decision to make. But we do have some significant collections, and then others may have part of their collection, they hold their papers with us, and part have gone elsewhere. So That's quite a complex matter that's determined when the negotiations occur between a minister or former minister and or his or her estate, for example, and whoever might be the recipient of those papers. So if you were researching a former minister's papers, it would be a good idea to have a fairly broad understanding of where they may have gone. They may have come here to Archives New Zealand. They may have remained with the family. They may have gone to Alexander Turnbull, for example. They may have gone to a university library. There are all sorts of places that would be options that you'd have to consider when doing your research.
Which leads perfectly into the question about how does one go about searching Archives New Zealand?
Well, research here is available to absolutely anyone. Assuming that any given record that you're interested is unrestricted, that it is open, you can simply come into the office that holds that record, and the majority of the records are held here in the Wellington office. If you're not already registered with us, you register with us. It takes about 4 minutes. It's a bit like getting a library card. All you need to bring with you is some photo ID. Most people bring in their driver's license or a passport. You can bring in student ID and various other forms of ID. We sign you up. We give you a card. And then you can request items to be brought to you in the reading room. You may need some assistance in working your way through the finding aids that we have, the various databases. They're not necessarily the easiest databases to work with. They are not, strictly speaking, catalogues, like a library catalogue. They are listing systems. But we have staff here always to assist people doing that research. It's best to bear in mind that although the majority of the records are here in the Wellington office, some records are held locally in Auckland, Christchurch or Dunedin, and that particularly applies to some records such as court records. So if you're wanting to look at records coming out of, for example, the Rotorua Supreme Court or Hamilton, Whangarei, Auckland or Tāhuhu District Court, all those kinds of records, you would be going to our Auckland office. And then similarly for those courts of Canterbury and Westland would be in the Christchurch office and Dunedin office holding the Otago and Southland court records. So there is some divvying up in that sense of records being held locally. But that's the approach is quite straightforward, and it's not limited to some instances. So you'll find around the world where you have to be a bona fide researcher. No, not here. You just are an interested person who wants to come in, and you can be a professional researcher. You can be a secondary school student doing your school assignments. It makes no difference to us in terms of the services we provide. You can ring us. I don't have the phone number to hand, but it's better if you're wanting to contact the Wellington office to email. If you're wanting to make first contact to discuss your research needs, then you can always just reach us at research.archives@dia.govt.nz. We will take your inquiry and get back to you, offering whatever advice we didn't, it seems appropriate at the time. It may be that we say, well, yes, we've got plenty of stuff here. Come on in and bring your ID, bring a camera. We encourage people to bring their own cameras. About 98% of the records we hold, we can permit, or we indeed encourage people to take their own photographs. So bring a camera, bring your ID, and begin your research.
And I do like the point you made a bit earlier about say looking at the truth to get a kind of a breadcrumb or the start of a trail, because I'm thinking that if you go to Archives New Zealand and say, I want to see something about homosexuality, I don't know the specifics. It must be very hard to actually kind of narrow it down. So actually, if you've got a newspaper article that you can go, okay, 1942, January, this is the name.
Yeah. newspaper articles, references given in published works are great. So if you were reading a published book or a report, monograph of some sort, and it gives reference to an Archives New Zealand item, they can be incredibly useful. If you're starting out from absolute scratch, then it's a very good idea to see what's out there in the published world. Someone's already more than likely done at least some of this research before, and if they are writing in a manner where they're wanting that information to be out there available, then hopefully they've given their references, and they can be incredibly useful for speeding your research up and helping you focus more precisely on what you want to research and how you can get to where you want to be. Other ways of focusing your research or getting those lead-ins will be simply to speak with other people who may have undertaken the research, as well as published books and so on. There may well be articles in either fairly popular journals or in academic journals and so on. So they're all worth having a look at as well. Going online, having a look online as well as hard copy can be really useful. Yep.
In your time at Archives New Zealand, what has been the most thrilling or most significant kind of rainbow discovery you've come across?
Not thrilling, but poignant, I think, is the one we mentioned earlier, this small record coming from the coroner's office about someone who lived her life and lived her life in a way that presumably was satisfactory to her, despite the constraints placed on her life in New Zealand in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. I find that a very, very poignant story, and the story of the probable difficulty of her husband after it was discovered that he had married someone who had been a boy and lived childhood and early adolescence as a boy before changing identity, although not changing physical nature. I find that a very poignant story, that there's a reality and a personal touch in there. The surviving partner speaks in that record of saying to the coroner and to the police, "This is the day I've been dreading." So that he had always worried that the life that they had led would perhaps be ridiculed, would certainly be held up to public gaze in a way that he certainly didn't want to be gazed at. And I think that's a powerful statement about many people's lives and those earlier generations who just wanted to live their lives in love and peace within community, and stigma prevented them doing so, or prevented them living it outwardly and openly. So that's the one I'll nominate for your question. I am quite touched by their story.